Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 104, Psychology and Cyber Sexuality, August 3rd, 2007. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
When you look in the sexual arena, the research shows that it's men who do most of the gender bending and identity tourism. Men, I think, they die 10 years earlier than women do. We need to look at that statistic. But men feel more constrained by their social role. And I hope that that's changing for men. So when they have the internet and they have the possibility to go online as a 14-year-old girl on a MySpace blog site, they are curious about what it's like to expand their identity.
That's the voice of my guest, Joni Gillespie, Ph.D., who is co-author of the 2007 book, Cyber Rules, What You Really Need to Know About the Internet. Dr. Gillespie received a doctorate in clinical psychology from the Fielding Graduate University, with an emphasis in health psychology. She works from systems and individual theories, utilizing psychodynamic and cognitive behavioral perspectives. She holds a professional postdoctoral training certificate from the University of California at Berkeley in neuropsychological assessment screening and a one-year advanced training in strategic depth psychotherapy. Her expertise is in the area of internet media, understanding the psychological and social effects of cyberspace and cyberculture. Her research, writing, and presentations about the internet include media literacy, cybersexuality, and the professional issues online for mental health consumers, practitioners, and organizations. She's also taught at UC Berkeley, Dominican University of California, and the University of Phoenix. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Joni Gillespie, welcome to the Wise Counsel podcast.
Thank you, David.
Well, I'm really glad to have you on this podcast. Actually, you and I had an earlier interview on my other podcast series, Wise Counsel, and actually that podcast hasn't been put up yet as of today's date, which is July 26th, 2007. It's in the rotation, it's been recorded, and that'll be coming up soon, but I was so energized by that discussion, and it seemed so important that I wanted to get you onto Shrink Wrap Radio with a somewhat different slant. And of course, on that earlier podcast, we were talking about the book that you recently co-authored, which is called Cyber Rules, What You Really Need to Know About the Internet. And the focus that I wanted us to have today is to get your input on the relationship between what's going on the internet and the World Wide Web and how that's impacting sexuality.
Great. I'm all yours.
Okay. Well, let me start off by asking you first, what led to your interest in the way that the internet and the World Wide Web are impacting sexuality?
Well, I think that my first interest was as an adolescent, and my experience as an adolescent in the eerie of the summer of love and in the world of hippies. I looked around at my friends and the world, and I was pretty shocked by how tough it was to be an adolescent. And I was always puzzled about why teenagers had to act out in ways that were unsafe, and where the adults were that we could rely on to help guide us through this uncharted territory of becoming an adult. So it was first my own experience, and then as a teacher, especially in high school, I would look at my kids in the classroom and I just thought, how can I teach these kids algebra when they were dealing with all of the issues of adolescent angst? And I finally decided that I would bribe them, that I could help them have better relationships with the opposite sex or same sex if they learned algebra, because algebra was a problem-solving model for the unknown.
Hmm.
And they all sat up and paid attention, and I realized that this was a key that resonated with with everybody, how to be a sexual person in an age where nobody wants to talk about it, and the models of sexuality we have aren't very edifying. Often they're negative models. And, of course, then when I became a clinician, people's sexualities were always at issue, even if it wasn't the presenting issue. And by what I mean by that is that we're all looking for love. And we all need intimacy and tenderness and love, yet we don't do that as well as we should, and our lives are very precious. We need to support and love one another much better, both in terms of sexual intimacy and also human intimacy. So then when I started to write my book and do research, what I found was from researchers, UCLA, Kaiser Family Foundation, Annenberg Foundation at the UPenn, University of Pennsylvania, that all of our interactions online are sexualized. So I thought it made a great place to study sexuality.
Yes, indeed. So how have the Internet and the World Wide Web changed or impacted our sense of eroticism and sexuality?
Well, I think because it's a mirror of who we are on ground. And the mirror that we have now shines deep into our own psyches and into our own bedrooms. It also shines on the rest of the world. So we can find out anything we want on the Internet, and we can connect with any part of the world. We can also connect with anyone who is interested in what we're interested in. So when you look at the Internet as an expanded opportunity for exploration, one of the most central ways we explore is who we are as human beings. So it is an expanded opportunity. It's an opportunity that happens anonymously. It happens easily. And it happens with great autonomy. We can find things out online, and we can connect with others in ways we never were able to do on ground.
Yeah, that's for sure. And what about gender-bending exploration? I mean, we can play with our identity and how we put ourselves out there and how we represent ourselves in relation to, well, gender is certainly one dimension, and there are other dimensions as well.
Well, I'm glad you said the word play, because if you ever watch a child, I think adults have lost the opportunities for play and joy in their lives. And when you see a child and their natural curiosity, you really get what joyful, exuberant living is all about. And so as adults, many of us are old and tired, and the only way people allow themselves to explore themselves in a playful way now may be online. And when you look in the sexual arena, the research shows that it's men who do most of the gender bending and identity tourism. Men, I think, they die 10 years earlier than women do. We need to look at that statistic. But men feel more constrained by their social role, and I hope that that's changing for men. So when they have the Internet and they have the possibility to go online as a 14-year-old girl on a MySpace blog site, they are curious about what it's like to expand their identities. And I was laughing to a dad's on the air in Sydney, Australia this week, and I said, you know, I can wear pants, and I can wear a skirt. I said, but you can't wear a skirt unless it's a kilt. And they said, well, there's some great drag queens in Sydney. And I said, I'm not talking about drag queens. I'm talking about regular men who may want to expand their identities on ground. They have a hard time doing it. And with every 8-year-old boy who cried on the playground at school, what are you called when you cry on the playground when you're an 8-year-old boy? You're called a girl.
Yep.
You're called gay. You're called a wuss. So boys learn very clearly that they can't express certain emotions, especially vulnerable ones.
Well, that's one of the first questions that pops up probably in many listeners' minds is when you say that more men than women are out there representing themselves as female. Is that an indicator that they are latently gay somehow, do you think?
No, I think it's more an indicator that they're curious and they feel shackled by being men in this
mm-hmm.
world. You know, we want men to talk and express themselves, but often women don't like what they have to say, and so they're silenced. Women are inherently sometimes more verbal. I think men are verbal too, but they've been silenced more than women have. And it's not a matter of men being wanting to be women. It's men also connect with other men sexually online, and they don't identify as homosexual. I have a sense that maybe bisexuality will become more the norm online. People can cross genders and sexual identities more easily without having to label themselves one thing or another. As a matter of fact, there was a large study in the California prison system that talked about men who have sex with men who are incarcerated. You know, our prison system is the largest in the world, so there's a great pool of study there. And men need a sexual outlet, and sometimes when they're in prison, they'll have sex with men, and then when they get out, they will not identify as homosexual, and often they carry a lot of shame around that.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we like to project parts of ourselves online. That is a way to explore the curious, but it's also a way maybe to practice, you know, things that we need to practice on ground a little more. You can practice inside a space. Some of that's very, very good, and, of course, some of that is very, very bad.
Okay, well, part of what I really liked so much about your book was the balanced approach that you take. And rather than being totally alarmist and reactionary, you examine in a pretty careful and objective way both the good and the bad, or what you referred to as sex positive and sex negative content and attitudes. And we can get into that in a bit. I think there are two threads to our discussion here that I see. One is the discussion about what all this means for us as adults, and the other has to do with what it all means for kids who are coming up now. So let's turn our attention for a bit to kids. And I know one of the things that you cited was a study done by Kaiser, called Kaiser being one of the largest healthcare systems maybe in the country, certainly in California, Kaiser Permanente. What did the Kaiser Internet Survey find about kids' life online?
Well, I want to direct any listener to kff.org, the great site for up-to-date research on the impact of the Internet on behavior and health. They found that kids are multitasking online 8 to 10 hours a day with no ill effects in their homework or their family duties or their roles in the community. And by 8 to 10 hours, I mean they add each media hour, even though kids and young people use media simultaneously. So it counts 1 hour if you're on the Internet, another hour if you're simultaneously listening to your iPod, and another hour if you're simultaneously text messaging your friends while you do your homework. So you can have multiple hours embedded within 1 hour. And that's how you get 8 to 10 hours a day. And those studies came out of data from 2003, 4, and 5. And, of course, in 2007, we have the wearable, immersible computer environments on our iPod and cell phones now. So I'm sure that has even gone up. So this is a very interesting phenomenon that the media, multimedia use is becoming embedded and portable into young people's lives and into, indeed, all of our lives.
Now, you said without ill effect on their grades and homework. Did I hear that
exactly, correctly?
Mm-hmm,
exactly.
That's surprising.
It is surprising. And basically, as a clinician, if you haven't addressed a problem on the ground, it will manifest online eventually. An addiction, a sleep disorder, depression. So when you see problems online, with the one exception, which is paraphilia and cybersexuality, deviant cybersexuality, with one exception, you need to address the problems you have in your offline life. If you don't, it's going to eventually migrate its way into cyberspace.
Yeah, I'm still interested in this no adverse effects, because when my kids were in high school and they wanted to multitask, you know, and listen to rock and roll music while doing their homework, as a parent, I really felt that I had to intervene and say, no, you can't listen to that music and do your homework. You know, that you're not going to be able to concentrate as well.
I can understand that. But that's when we had, the only music we ever heard was on an LP, and you had to be in the family living room to hear it. Now music is portable, and they can carry it anywhere. And we know sometimes that white noise, which is lots of noise in the background, is actually sometimes masked the interference and lets kids concentrate. If you spend any time in a classroom and see how many distractions and how much noise there is in a classroom, it's a wonder that any student can learn. The kids are very good, don't we remember, at tuning out noise, including parent noise, teacher noise, other students' noise. If you've ever ridden on BART recently, there's so much noise, you have to learn how to tune it out so you can still focus and concentrate. And so many kids report that they need this stimulation white noise as a background modulator. And I say to parents, you know, proof is in the pudding. How are their grades?
Yes.
So if their grades are good, then they need to learn how to be in the world. Now, some people can't have any noise at all. I think it's more a temperament thing. But our youngsters now from the age of 9 months old, this is what the Kaiser study found, is the age of first media use, where nine-month-old babies can move around a mouse or a ball and see the changes on the screen. So they learn how to use digital media in a multimodal format, probably before they can walk and talk. Right about 9 months old is when the early toddlers begin to walk. But this is quite profound at the changes that are going to arise in children's brains with their exposure to multimedia.
Well, that's a whole other interesting area, is that, in fact, there may be some interaction between these technologies and brain development. Is there actual research that supports that yet?
Not yet, but when I talk to neuroscientists and neurosurgeons and neuropsychologists, they all agree that it all happens in the brain. Your sense of identity, your sexual arousal, your behavior, your emotional state. So it really makes sense, and your visual cortex, of course, is a very powerful learning modality, and that's the primary one that's developing in the first 2 years of life, as well as your motor skills. So it makes sense that when you add in media into your developmental stages at very critical periods of life, you are going to maximize the effect that media has. For example, we know that if children don't learn how to crawl, if they have an accident and break their legs, for example, in the stage of crawling development, that if they're 3 years old and the cast come off, they don't walk. They first have to learn how to crawl. So there are some very critical periods of development, and I know that media is now right on board at almost every period of critical development for young people, and this will have profound effects in their neural anatomy as well as their social relationships and, of course, their behaviors.
Well, this is really fascinating. I was reading an article just last night at the New Yorker about the Bionic Woman, I think was the title of the article, and it was talking about prostheses for people who've had their limbs blown off or lost limbs in accidents, and the progress that they're making in terms of being able to get the brain to relearn how to drive these devices, in essence, to map these devices, these external devices, onto the brain. And what occurs to me is that these devices, such as iPods and video game controllers and cell phones, are literally becoming extensions of ourselves. These are tools that are every bit as much a part of us, really, almost as our hand. So certainly our brain must be developing in ways to accommodate the use of this prosthesis, if you will.
Absolutely. A wonderful website is the MIT Media Lab website, which talks about neural implants in the brain for quadriplegics. It also talks about prosthetic devices. There's an MIT researcher who walks on stage. She's 6'2", got very gorgeous long legs in high heels, and she says, "I have legs. I have 10 pairs of them in my closet."
Wow.
And she talks about her prosthetic devices, that she had her legs amputated when she was 1 year old. And she is an MIT researcher now in prosthetic devices, and using that technology embedded into your neural wiring in your brain to help drive the prosthetic device. And it's very fascinating. And we do know that as computers become more embedded into our lives and into our bodies, that it's going to really open up a whole new world of ethics and of human development and what really does it mean to be human. It's a very exciting place to be as a researcher and a psychologist, and it's just as a human being. I think we're all fascinated with the cyber issues and what that means for our world and what that means for ourselves.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I'm very plugged in myself. I am what people call a crackberry addict. I've got a BlackBerry, and I'm kind of checking it all the time, and I'm just barely able to restrain myself from rushing out and buying an iPhone. I'm holding back a little bit, but there will definitely be an iPhone on my horizon. And
well, then I'll ask you the same question that most parents do. Has it had any ill effects on your life? And if it does, then you know how to cut back or modify what you're doing. You know, adults are so concerned about what teenagers are doing online, but I say first, hey, who makes the media models? It's adults. And look at your own media use. Is it altering your life in a way that's not healthy? We all have 24 hours in the day, and that's the rubric where I start with patients and with myself. What am I able to accomplish? And I need 8 hours of sleep, or I'm really cranky, and I need an hour's of worth of exercise every day, or I can't sit and talk to people about their own health issues. So those are the things that we really need to pay attention to first. We need to examine ourselves, and we need to take our own pulses first. And then we need to look at how this is affecting our world of the great issues in the cyber sky right now.
Right.
It's a wonderful world of exploration.
Well, certainly, you know, without turning the tables and me becoming a therapy patient here, I would have to respond to your question and acknowledge that, in fact, you know, I see ways in which all of this has impacted me and changed me, not all for the good. I think I'm less patient than I used to be since I got involved with computers. The computer gives me quick responses. I can try out a number of possibilities right away, and if something isn't working, I can quickly move on to the next and keep fiddling with it until it works right. Whereas people are much slower, they're harder to control, etc. So I do notice in myself a shorter attention span, less patience, also that on whole I'm spending much less time with people and more time plugged in either to the computer or the TV or the iPod or podcasting. So there really are some questions that that I need to look at for myself. And of course, I have that all too human tendency to project my issues on other people. And certainly that's what I was doing with my kids. As you pointed out, you know, I was telling my kids, well, you can't multitask. Well, the truth was probably I'm not as good at multitasking as evidently they were. And another kind of side note is it's interesting for me to see how my standards have changed and evolved as time goes on. I remember being very upset with my daughter because she was spending so much time listening to ABBA, the Scandinavian rock group ABBA. And I just thought, you know, that was horrible that she was plugged into ABBA all the time. And one of my sons was watching The Simpsons, and I thought, oh, that was just not a socially responsible kind of cartoon series. Well, as time has gone on, ABBA seems so sweet in retrospect, so tame and so sweet and so much like a Sunday school picnic. You know, I long for the days of ABBA to return, and The Simpsons is wonderfully satirical and funny, and I recognize that and accept that now. At the same time, having said that, it seems like the things that kids are getting exposed to today and that are engaged in are just leagues beyond ABBA and The Simpsons. And maybe you can discuss that.
Well, you bring up so many great points. And the first one is that if, as psychologists, this is a joke on psychology, if somebody ever says, hey, it's all good without addressing what things aren't good, then we look at it as mania or psychosis. In other words, if when you evaluate anything, you need to bring a dialectical process and always look at the opposing point of view, the 180. So when you look at your online lives and your behaviors and you realize, wait a minute, it's making you a little more irritable, and maybe it's reducing your attention span. Those are very important things to look at in what you want to accomplish in a 24-hour day. However, even though you may have a shorter attention span, it is expanding our ability to multitask in many ways. Now, I'm a multitasker because I raised a lot of kids, had a job, and got my doctorate at the same time. And multitasking in many cultures is the norm. In collectivist cultures, for example, the studies are that they can use the internet modalities more effectively than our linear myopic, Western, logical, sequential kind of culture. And we need to learn to lighten up, loosen up a little bit, and observe and experience lots of things at the same time, because that indeed is what life is about. But on the other hand, if we do that, we have to be very careful not to lose track of what I call depth. We need to be able to have long-term, sustainable relationships with people and work through difficult times. And I'm concerned that young people are learning a lot of social skills online, and they're experiencing a lot of different things, and the range is awesome and sometimes awful. But we need to make sure that they know how to have face-to-face human connections as well, and not just have the modality, oops, this relationship's too tough, I think I'll click this one off and move on to the next one.
Mm-hmm.
So I am concerned that we need to balance this more. We need to balance our online lives with very robust and meaningful offline lives. And there's so much online right now that if you let yourself, you can be buried in it.
Yes.
You know, I'm working on a curriculum, and I'm looking at YouTube, and it can suck up 5 hours of my time just getting images off of YouTube for my curriculum. And I've got a lot to do in a 24-hour day, as do most people, and most of it we don't want to spend whacking away at the keyboard.
Right.
So I think there's some very, very wonderful ways that adults can model more appropriate behavior online, but also recognize where kids are more experts than we are. And the internet is one of them.
Yes. Now, what about the content that kids are potentially exposed to? You talked about the natural curiosity of kids and how you were curious when you were an adolescent. And kids are tremendously curious, and you can see or do just about anything on the internet. So can you comment about the dark side of what's going on, and then how one somehow finds balance with that?
Well, I think adults need to reclaim their authority, and they need to become much more expert at helping kids understand their environment, including the online environment, and this is not happening. So when you look at what kids can access online, and I call it beyond depravity, we need to help them understand the messages that are inherent in the media that they're viewing. We've never done that with print media and with television media and music media enough. But now that it's online, it's now interactive. And this makes the power of what they're doing online much more imminent in changing their behaviors and hardwiring and relationships. So we need to say to kids, what is health and what is ill health? What is harmful and what is loving and positive? We've never explained that to kids enough. So when you look at what's online, I like to really dumb it down to sex positive and sex negative, since we know that the internet is a sexualized place, and so is media. When you do that with kids and you ask them to define what would be sex positive, what is the positive relationship, the first thing that kids usually come up with is respect. They usually say, you know, don't disrespect me. They know that respect is a huge construct. They know what it feels like not to be respected. So they put that first. And so then I say, translate that to the internet. If you see a scenario or media that's not respectful, then you have to deconstruct respect, which means developmentally appropriate interaction.
Well, at what age would you begin having this discussion with a child?
Well, I would say the accurate age is right about when they start to talk.
Really?
And you make it developmentally appropriate. As we teach kids potty training, actually their bodies teach themselves, but we go along with what's socially acceptable as their potty training. And you use the words that are very concrete with their bodily functions. And you explain to them what is appropriate socially and what is not, what is healthy, and what are healthy ways to grow into this stage of controlling parts of their body and their functions. And you start there, and then when you get to be 3, 4, and 5, of course, is the developmentally appropriate age for them to be curious about their bodies and other people's bodies. And it's very developmentally appropriate, and I used to teach preschool, to have 3 and 4-year-olds explore each other's bodies. But it is not appropriate, for example, to have a 9-year-old exploring a 4-year-old's body. So that's where the developmentally appropriate respect comes in. It's appropriate if you find kids playing doctor and they're the same age and they're under the age of 6. It's not appropriate if one of them is over the age of 7 or 8 and is playing doctor with somebody who's 3 or 4. So this is where you start to have kids understand their bodies, their bodily functions, and where they stop and other people begin. So when you get up to the age of latency, and latency is the age of pre-puberty, which is getting younger and younger, by the way. So right. 9-year-olds now in many cultures in the United States are females are starting their periods. They're starting menses. And 20, 30 years ago, it was age 11. Now it's 9 and 10. So the ages of latency are shrinking. Just all the while, the ages of exposure to sexualized cultures are expanding. So what we're getting are many parents come into my office and they have a 10 or 11-year-old just driving them crazy. And I said, well, you have a teenager on your hands. And they're shocked because the big push for puberty starts before the secondary sexual characteristics are visible. So you're always shocked when the hormones kick in because you don't see the hormones kick in. You just see the results of that, which are maybe labile behaviors, acting out, mood swings, those kinds of things. So how do we help teenagers, young teenagers? We do a better job than they're getting in school. This is where the Internet is a very positive force for teenagers. I call it the best sex ed on the planet. It tells kids anything they want to know about sex and sexuality. The problem is they have to figure out what's accurate and what's not accurate. And if they don't have adults to ask in their lives, then they're consuming a lot of negative messages and they don't even know it. And that's a real problem.
Yes, there's such a fusion of violence with sexuality. For example, in video games and in rap music and so on. So what's your take on that, and how does one, I mean, isn't there the chance that a young person who is developing their sexuality will get imprinted or have eroticized for them something that really shouldn't be eroticized just because of the early exposure and the fact that there might be an accompanying arousal?
Well, we know from all of the research that early exposure to sexual scripts shapes your sexual scripts. So when very, very often a very high percentage, over 90% of pedophiles, for example, have been molested themselves as children, and if you develop a paraphilia or a sexual deviant kind of behavior or fetish, usually the paraphilia develops in childhood and adolescence. So we know that early sexual exposure to anything, but especially sexual scenarios, shape your sexual repertoire. And this is a very powerful modality, and it goes into the visual cortex, and it gets reinforced by the sexual response and arousal. You have paired whatever the response is or the experience is to your sexual arousal, and it gets imprinted that way for the rest of your life. And paraphilias, some of them are not harmful or illegal, like a rubber fetish with a consenting adult partner is not harmful, but a fetish that may result in physical harm or death to someone certainly is a problem. Pedophilia, child molesting, as well as pederasty, sex with animals. There's so much sex with animals on the Internet, I just call it all donkey porn as my euphemism for the depraved sexual scenarios that you see online that are so accessible to young people. So when kids are exposed to that, and I don't mean coming across it, you know, even once a day, coming across it and sort of clicking off it and moving on to your, you know, assignment you should be doing in social studies, that's not going to harm kids. Sweden has done a study that they said about 3 times a day connecting to deviant porn alters the adolescent arousal towards the deviancy. Now, that's Sweden. They study adolescent sexuality. They have a very open, inquisitive inquiry around adolescent sexual health and adult sexual health. We don't have that here in this country. We don't fund adolescent sexual research, especially what they're doing online. So we don't know. 3 times a day, I would say, to me, sounds high. If you have a child who already feels isolated or may have an undiagnosed anxiety disorder or may be depressed, if they're going on to deviant sex sites, donkey porn sites, and seeing underage sex, seeing sex paired with violence, seeing sex that is unusual and deviant with objects or people, they're going to be training their sexual response to be aroused to that scenario. And I think that's very dangerous. But if they come across it accidentally, even a couple times a week, probably not harmful. But I would say that once a day, if they're going towards it for arousal once a day, that they're developing a repetitive behavior that has a strong chance of turning into a compulsion, which has a strong chance of turning into a sexual impulse control problem in their life.
Hmm.
Does that sound reasonable?
Yeah. Although it's tough for a parent. In one place, you write, discipline tactics that are authoritarian or permissive don't work either online or offline because they do not teach kids but rely on censorship and ignorance to control them. Now, what do you mean by that?
Well, discipline, we've done a lot of research on parenting styles, 40, 50 years. The research is pretty clear that authoritarian models that are do this because I say so don't work. They don't teach skills. They just control kids. And permissive or laissez-faire parenting styles where kind of anything goes and what do you want to do, sweetie, that doesn't work either because you're not teaching kids some of the really important messages that they need to learn and incorporate into their behavior. The middle road, which is authoritative, is based on parenting knowledge of what kids need at various developmental stages. Parents need to study more what are the stages of development and what do kids need at certain ages. They don't need any kind of a license to have a child. You need more of a study of your driver's license or to pick up a dog from the pound. You need to know more about animal development, and you need to sign a lot of forms that you will be safe with this animal and give this animal what this animal needs, but you need nothing along those lines if you're going to have a baby. And we do need to change that because the world takes a lot of study. We can no longer assume that everybody's going to move through life without harm. We're too connected to each other now, and we are too crowded, so we need to really learn more. So authoritative parenting is based on knowledge. Then you can say to your child, okay, if you do this, you really risk being harmed, but if you can convince me that you will be safe, and you understand the risks, and your past behavior has shown that I understand and trust what you say, then convince me. And what I like to say is at age 15, 15-year-olds don't drive for a good reason alone. If you're going to give your 16-year-old the car keys, you've done it because they've passed certain skill levels, but they've also achieved a developmental milestone at home and at school in their community. And if they haven't, they shouldn't have the car keys, and they shouldn't have the keyboard. And if you can give them the car keys, then you're ready to have them out in the world with a huge weapon that could hurt and harm people. And the same goes for the keyboard. It is a license to drive in cyberspace. And if you're not safe with them on ground, they shouldn't be in cyberspace alone.
In one article, you give advice to parents, and you mentioned sort of five approaches or keys, which are safety, netiquette, no delete, kinky sex, the 24-hour rule. Can you briefly take us through each of those five? What do you mean? What are you referring to by safety?
Well, as any parent knows and admits, if their teenager has sex or is doing drugs or is drinking or is doing something, it's a big problem. But our bigger problem is their lives. That safety with young people is our number one concern. So we teach kids to cross the street. And I've adopted that model of skills and to the internet. You would never let a toddler run across the street alone. You carry them or hold their hand up until certain ages, maybe 6, 7, 8, 9, depending where you live, and depending on their impulsivity and their personality. So use the model of crossing the street when it comes to cyberspace. You either carry them or hold them hands online, which supervised all the time. Then when they get to be a little older, based on their own maturity, you can let them use the internet with some real guidelines about what they're doing for how long and when, and you check up on them all the time. And then around 13 or 14, they go to people's houses for the night, and you have to give them some autonomy out in the world also on cyberspace, but you do check their history. You tell them that ahead of time, that you will randomly check their history, that you will discuss any text messages or websites that they've been to that you think they need to learn about, and they also can bring you their concerns. You want children to be able to talk to you, and then when they start to talk to you about difficult things, it's very important to keep you cool and to ask for a timeout if you start to get angry, and so their safety is your primary concern. By the time kids are in teenagers, they're going to be on, whether you like it or not, not either right under your nose and still doing whatever they want to, or they'll be at their friend's house or on their iPod or cell phone at school. So that's when they really need to learn how to navigate safely, and you can tell them about the criteria for deviancy, and you can also tell them that one of the areas is about being online is that there's no delete. So anything that you put online can be out in cyberspace for the rest of their lives and come back to haunt them later.
Yes, there are some Miss America pageant type young women who are discovering that as things that have gone up on the internet are now coming back to haunt them, or people looking for jobs, right?
That's right. And, you know, I think it's I get sort of distressed by the way our culture loves bad news and they love gossip. And I wish that we could spend more time in compassionate understanding of people rather than excoriating them for being human. We need a lot more authenticity, and no one's perfect. We're all a work in progress. So when we have so much media that's based on so much pure interest, for me, it's somebody isn't getting any themselves. That's why they're so interested in other people's lives. And it's unfortunate because it makes us sort of be peeping toms into other people's privacy and business that shouldn't be on front page news. There's way more important things that we need to be addressing, not other people's private lives or their half-naked pictures that they put on MySpace.
Yes. Now, what were you referring to when you used the word netiquette and as one of the five talking points to parents?
Well, I'm pretty shocked, and even though I'm really flexible and quite progressive, I'm pretty shocked at people's bad manners. I always was. I was a teacher, and I had guest lecturers. I made my students stand up and say hello and shake hands and look people in the eye. People don't have those basic skills. When I'm a professor in different schools, and I shake my students' hand when they come in the door, and I look in their eyes. We don't teach people decent manners on ground. So when you go translate into cyberspace, that is the very impulsive, anonymous place to be, the propensity is to just let it all hang out. And it's very hard to make sure that what you say is defensive or overly sexual. I think I sent you an email today with, here's my phone number, I'm ready. And then I thought to myself, well, I'm ready is kind of like a sexual term sometimes. And I thought, I was just laughing, and I said, well, no wonder it's all sexual online. So even when you don't mean to be sexual or insulting, sometimes you come across that way just by the modality of using text. And when we all type online, we're always in a hurry, and sometimes we don't spell check it, we don't preview it, we read it, we just hit send, and there it goes. But the impulsivity online increases people's ability to be angry and not pay the price. There's a lot of cyberbullying, of course, which is entirely inappropriate. But that's largely because we're not dealing with the bullying issues on ground. And it's not just kids on playgrounds who bully. It's the adult model bullying kids. They're misusing their power. So there's a lot of press about kids cyberbullying, but I think adults need to first take their own pulse and see where they bully their children. And that's netiquette. Don't do anything online that you wouldn't want to receive online or that couldn't come offline.
Yes. Now, two other points that we haven't touched on. One was kinky sex. I'm not sure what you were implying about that in your message in your advice to parents, and the 24-hour rule.
That's right. Well, kinky sex is just a tongue-in-cheek that we haven't really even decided what pornography or inappropriate smut is. Even the Supreme Court had a hard time defining it. We've never been able to really define it beyond something that exists just for pure interest and has no artistic value. Well, somebody might call something positive erotica in San Francisco and depraved pornography in Kansas. It's
yes.
Just a matter of where you live or in the Middle Eastern countries, for example. So defining kinky sex really is in the eye of the beholder, which comes out of the culture within which you live. But clinicians understand that sexual impulse control disorders, which are paraphilia, they thrive online because they can. There are no controls. There are nothing that you can censor online in the sexual arena, and it's so easily accessible. So we know that paraphilias develop in childhood, so So as I said before, if kids go on to deviant sex sites, which are all over the net, I can't do research on cyber sex without coming up with what I call XXX rated sexual scenarios.
Yes.
And it's very distressing. We need to explain to kids, just like with smoking, it's bad for you. Looking at lots of deviant sex makes you want to crave deviant sex. It's not that complicated, and kids will get it. And I don't think we need to quantify it that if you do it three times a day or once a day, it'll have a high chance. But we need not to scare them that if they see it once or twice or come across it when doing stuff online, it's not going to hurt them. It's if they do it compulsively.
So, do you think the parents should sit down with a kid at some point and look at some of that stuff and talk about it?
I think so. Well, as a parent, would you rather you do it or somebody else? Would you rather you do it, no one do it, or somebody else do it?
Yeah.
Sometimes, you know, parents say, I'm just comfortable with this. And then I say, well, find a good friend or a family member that you trust that is comfortable. And, you know, you can look at, starting with print media, social images with kids, and you can ask them, okay, what's sex positive about this picture and what's sex negative? If you look at the perfume Addict, ADDICT, by Dior, there is a front picture of a girl who looks 12 in a very seductive pose, and you can ask kids to deconstruct that picture. What are the messages in it? What's sex negative and what's sex positive? They're very good consumers of media, and they can tell you, well, she's 12 years old, and she's coming across in a very seductive way. I did a workshop in a library, and 11-year-olds had no problem saying that to me when I held up the picture.
Mm-hmm.
So you can start with those kinds of pictures, and with some of the more explicit pictures, there are blackout areas of genitals, but you can see what the face sheet looks like, and I'd say for older teenagers, you may be able to use those and say to them, look at this picture. It is disrespectful because they are these three young women who look younger than 18 servicing this one man, and they're being objectified and exploited. That is sex negative.
Okay.
So there are ways to do it without having to look at explicitly sexual pictures that you can teach your teenagers, and then they get that piece. You know, kids are savvy. They get that piece. So helping them at the appropriate developmental ages is very important in understanding what kinky sex is. Kinky sex is not healthy on ground, so don't do it online either.
Sex education has been very controversial in terms of doing sex ed in the schools. Where do you come down on that?
Well, I come down hard and fast on the fact that we're doing a very bad job on sex education. Many studies have come out that the abstinence-based curriculum doesn't work. It's not comprehensive enough. And kids who experience that abstinence-only curriculum may delay sex, but when they do initiate sex, they're least likely to use protection and practice safer sex. So we know that this sex ed in the schools isn't effective. And I would say to parents, do you really want to leave it up to the school's cyberspace or your peers, if your children's peers, to teach them sex education? I hope not. And one of the places online people can go to are sexual information clearinghouses. Dr. Drew has a great website for teenagers. And there's some great information online now for sexuality education that teaches kids information about themselves and to how to achieve sexual health for their entire lives. And I really think the internet is the place where kids are going to learn how to be positive sexual human beings. And I'm very glad for that, because we're not doing a good enough job. Adults are not doing a good enough job. Our teenagers have the worst sexual health of any industrial country in the world.
Wow. Now, as a psychologist yourself, what role should psychology and or psychologists play in relation to cybersexuality?
Well, I like that question, because as psychologists, I think we're educators first and then healers. Sometimes if we don't have a good therapeutic connection with somebody, we may not be able to help them solve or heal some of the problems in their lives, but we're always educators. We have knowledge, and it's incumbent upon us to share. As a matter of fact, our ethics say we need to give psychology away. We need to help people understand themselves. So we are educators, and we can take a central role in helping them understand the online and offline issues But most of my colleagues are too busy to try to figure it out. But more and more of them, and I'd say over 50% of colleagues in any state in this country and indeed all over the world, are experiencing patients who come in with cyber problems. So we need to be responsive to what our patients' issues are. So now some of their issues are online, and we need to understand how to deal with it.
Okay, well, I think we've run out of time here. So Dr. Joni Gillespie, thanks so much for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thanks so much, David. I really enjoy your questions.
I hope you enjoyed this interview with Joni Gillespie. I was fortunate enough recently, just in the past couple of weeks, I had the pleasure of meeting her for lunch. We had never met before, but because of the first interview that I did with her and the fact that she's in the Bay Area, we decided to get together for lunch. And I can tell you, she is very sharp. And not only is she a very experienced clinician, but she's really on top of a huge amount of the research literature, especially relating to the internet and its psychological impact, or its psychosocial impact, if you will. One of the things that we discussed was the possibility that these shrink wrap radio episodes might qualify for professional CE units, that is, continuing education for professionals. And that's certainly something that has been suggested to me before, and that I continue to be interested in. I want these shows to be able to be turned to as many uses and to be of as much value to people as possible. And I have, in fact, been working on becoming a CE unit provider, and that's still in process. She also let me know that there's a vast army of teachers out there who are in constant need of CE units. And that's something that that the two of us might collaborate on, is either with this podcast or maybe developing some other audio content, something that we talked about. Joni's co-author on the Cyber Rules book is an eminent research psychologist at a Canadian university. Her name is Jane Gockenbach, and I was already familiar with that name because she's one of the foremost researchers on dreaming and also on video and computer games. Now, coincidentally, I had an opportunity to meet and to hear Jane Gockenbach present at the recent International Association for the Study of Dreams conference. And she's definitely a formidable presence in her own right. And these two women together make a real powerhouse of a team. So I can really recommend the book to you, because both of them are extremely competent and articulate and know their stuff. And I'm hoping to get around to interviewing Dr. Gockenbach at some point. I tried to pin her down at the Dream Conference, but there was just too much going on. I'm glad to finally have an episode that deals at least somewhat with sexuality. I've been feeling that there's a gap in that area in this series, and I intend to, but part of my intent here is to keep the rating for this show on iTunes and elsewhere clean, but I believe we should be able to talk about the psychology of sex without violating that standard. Let me know if you'd like to hear more along these lines, that is, about sexuality. Now, as synchronicity would have it, and isn't synchronicity always lurking in the background here somewhere? Seems to be. I've been doing market research all this week for a client that had me conducting online interviews with adults about their tastes and preferences and so on when it comes to viewing adult video material. It was quite enlightening, and I wish I could tell you what I found out, but I signed a non-disclosure agreement. So I guess I've shared just enough to tease you and no more. And after all, that's part of sex anyway, isn't it?
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again. Yeah. It's all in your head. It's all in your head. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head.
Hey folks, I am really stoked. This is another red letter day for Shrink Wrap Radio. And let me tell you why. I received an email from listener Penny, who is a school counselor in Santa Monica, California. And she wrote, "Dear Dr. Dave, I just got my August-September issue of Scientific American Mind. And right there on page 20 is a blurb on Shrink Wrap Radio. Congratulations." She goes on to say, "I've shared your website with all my therapist friends, and now I'm so very pleased that your podcast is getting the attention it deserves. Take care and keep up the good work." Hey, Penny, thanks so much. And so, of course, I got very excited, and I asked Penny if she could send me a copy of whatever this magazine had to say. And so after several tries, she succeeded in faxing it to me. And it's in a section that they call calendar, and they recommend two podcasts. The other one is a series on the history of psychology coming out of the University of Akron. And then they recommended Shrink Wrap Radio. As a matter of fact, I can tell you what they said. They said, "Every week, psychology professor David Van Nuys of Sonoma State University interviews a leading psychologist about his or her specialty, covering a broad range of topics from research, probably from research on health to spirituality and even business leadership. The animated discussion often delves into the personalities of the host and guests, affording listeners a rare glimpse of the people behind the science." So I don't know how to communicate just how exciting that is to me, because, of course, Scientific American is a very respected and widely distributed print publication, and Scientific American Mind evidently is a spinoff of that magazine that covers issues relating directly to psychology. So I didn't even know psychology and neuroscience and so on. And I didn't even know about that magazine. Since they did me the favor of mentioning me, I immediately went out and subscribed. And I'm also planning to approach them to see if they might be interested in becoming a sponsor for this show, because boy, they would make such a natural sponsor. So thanks again, Penny, for calling that to my attention, and I'm just really excited. I want to let you know that there's a new episode of my other podcast, which you'll find at www.wisecounselpodcast.com. And there I interview John Clarkin, PhD, of Cornell University, and the interview is on transference-focused therapy for borderline personality disorder. So all you therapists and counselors in training will be particularly interested in that interview, I think. So you should go right over there and listen to it at some point. Now, in the interview, you heard what a techie fanatic I am, checking my BlackBerry many times every hour, and I've been barely able to restrain myself from rushing out and buying the new iPhone, but I've shown remarkable restraint. However, I'm wondering if any of you out there are listening to this show on an iPhone yet. Be sure to let me know if you are. It will be another Shrink Wrap Radio first. Now, speaking of technical stuff, if you're listening to this show but not subscribed, please do subscribe. It costs you nothing. On the right-hand side of each page at shrinkwrapradio.com is an icon that says Subscribe in iTunes. Just click on that and follow the link. And speaking of iTunes, we saw our biggest jump in listeners back when iTunes featured us for a short time on their podcast page. Now, there's no certain way to make that happen again, but one ingredient that does seem to help is getting as many positive reviews on the iTunes site as possible. So many of you have written me with wonderful feedback. Can I get you to go to the iTunes store, then to the Shrink Wrap Radio page in the iTunes store, and then to leave some of those choice comments there in the form of a review. If you'll do that, it'll be a big help, and I'm thanking you in advance. Sadly, there 2 weeks in a row now, there are no new additions to the Frapper map. So if you're not on our map, there's a place on the Shrink Wrap Radio website where you can add yourself to the Shrink Wrap Radio Frapper map and save me the frustration of looking there every day and finding no new people. Now, finally, the sponsors for this show are Podshow and GoDaddy. Remember to use the code SHRINK3 at checkout from GoDaddy to get a discount on your next domain name or web hosting purchase.
Hi, this is Andrea Koch from Berlin, Germany at the IASD Dream Conference. Wake up from your dream with Dr. Dave.
Thanks, Andrea from Germany. Let's catch up on a few back emails. I received one from longtime listener Cody. It's too long to read here, but among other things, she says, "Dear David, thanks for notifying me that you fixed number 101, the bitch, the crone, and the harlot." Yes, I initially put it up, and the sound quality was so bad that I had to go back in and massage it quite a bit, and then I reloaded it. So if you heard the bad version and couldn't understand it, you might want to go back again. As Cody says, I went again and listened to the show, and this time the sound quality was very good. It's a great show. Also, I agree with you, it has a very provocative title, and in my humble opinion, if you have a little money for your old age, you don't have to look like a crone. And to tell you the truth, I just couldn't understand the harlot thing, but maybe that's because my not understanding that part could be because of the fact that I grew up in an ultra-Orthodox Jewish family. And Cody went on to remark that she liked my comments after that episode, and in particular my story about walking down the street behind my super handsome son and watching the girls' heads turn. And Cody says, she says, "You shouldn't be sorry that today you don't turn heads around on the street as you used to. It isn't such a big problem. For example, I see you found another way to pull the attention to you. You have that wonderful show that pulls attention to your warm personality." So thank you very much for that compliment, Cody. And yeah, I think you're right. This probably is an alternate way for me to get attention. Christina in Canada writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. I'm not actually sure how long I've been listening to your show, but I'm fairly certain I discovered your show through a link on the Sonic Society webpage." Yeah, we've helped to promote one another, so thank you, Sonic Society, for that, and Jack Ward. She says, "I'm a bit behind on the show at the moment. I'm subscribed to over 40 podcasts. I like all the dream shows that you did. The Unabomber and Zodiac show I found particularly interesting. I don't really have an interest in the Zodiac Killer himself, but I have a vague interest in Jack the Ripper, at least in comparison to all the other serial killers out there. I also enjoyed Anna, the Anna is a Man on Love show. It was awesome." Oh, he'll be glad to hear that, and I am too. She says, "I was wondering if you ever do a show on ADD, or rather ADHD, as the name has been changed, and I have no clue why. I'm not hyperactive. I have had ADD when I was young, and I'm just really curious about it. When I signed up for Intro to Psych, I thought they would brush on it, but no, they didn't. And when I signed up for my biopsych class, I also hoped that they would poke at ADD, but they didn't. And that class gave me more of a headache than my philosophy class did." Well, maybe not, but I'm sure it was quite close. Christina from Canada. Christina, thanks for those observations. Yeah, I'm surprised I haven't had anything on ADHD yet. I'm sure I will. And very likely, if I do, it may be more likely to appear on my other podcast series, Wise Counsel. I'll let you know if and when it does. That is, I'll let you know here, so you'll have to keep listening if you want to hear about that. Also, I get emails from people that, I got one just recently, and I don't know where it is, but a person said, "I've gone back and listened to all the shows back to number 25. So, hey, why not listen to all of them? They're not all on the iTunes feed anymore because the feed got to be too big. So if you want to hear the very first shows, you have to go back into the archives on our website, where over on the left, you'll find that the shows are listed by month and year. And if you start down at the bottom of the list, you'll be able to hear some of the very fine early shows that are no longer in the feed. So that better wrap it up for today. Remember, you can send your emails to me, shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave voicemails on Skype, where the name is ShrinkPod. I encourage you to leave voice messages on MyChingo, and there's a logo for that on our ShrinkWrap Radio website that you can click on. And also, there is voicemail phone at 206-337-0622. It's been a long time since I've gotten a voice message from anyone. Thanks again to Dr. Joni Gillespie for her insights on cybersexuality. And please join us for our next show, which will be with Dr. Stephen Post on why good things happen to good people. And that good people is it for now. This is Dr. Dave saying it's all in your mind.